Call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:05 p.m. on Thursday, April 13th, 2023. We're meeting today in Davis Room 106 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phone out of courtesy to others. All right, so committee members in attendance today, Representative Sumner, Representative Sadler, Representative Ruffridge, Representative McCormick, Representative Fields, and Representative Mina, and myself, the chair, Representative Prox. We have a quorum to do business. So welcome back. And I also like to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye, to our right, and our returning House Recorder, Suniva St. Clair, and our teleconference moderator, Amanda. All right, thank you for being with us. All right, today we have confirmation hearings of governor's appointees. There are three of them. And the first on the list is David Barnes for the State Medical Board. And is he online?
Yes.
Mr. Barnes.
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please introduce yourself for the record and let us learn about you.
Okay. I'm David Barnes. I understand I'm being recorded and that this is a confirmation hearing. Let me just open by giving a brief overview of my background, and I'll make a short statement, and then we'll answer any questions you have. I was born and raised in a rural part of southern Minnesota. My mom grew up on a farm, so in summers, my brothers and I worked at Grandpa's farm in northern Iowa. While in high school, I got a private pilot's license at age 17 and then went on to get a commercial pilot's license, instrument rating, and ultimately became a CFI. I graduated, which is a certified flight instructor, I graduated from Gustavus Adolphus College, which was a liberal arts college in southern Minnesota in 1985 with a bachelor's degree in Russian studies and most of my pre-med work completed. My career plans took a little detour when I worked for the National Security Agency, the NSA, for 9 years from 1986 to 1995. While with NSA in the Washington, D.C. area, I completed 1 year of a master's degree program in national security studies at Georgetown University, but then had a permanent change of station with NSA and was unable to go any further with that. I went to medical school then from 1995 to 1999 at the University of North Texas Health Science Center in Fort Worth. I graduated from that and completed an internal medicine residency at St. Joseph Hospital in Denver. That's the largest private hospital in Denver, Colorado. That was from 1999 until 2002. The year after graduating from residency, I worked in the major hospitals of Denver as a hospitalist with critical care and pulmonary consultants. And we basically took care of all the inpatient hospitalized patients on the medical wards and in the intensive care units. I was recruited by Valley Hospital in Palmer, and my family and I moved to Palmer in June of 2003. For the first 6 years up here in Palmer, I did combined work both in the hospital and outpatient in a clinic in Wasilla. And once we got a hospitalist group up and running, I switched just to clinic outpatient care. I've been married to my wife, Susan, since 1996. She's a veterinarian, and I have five boys, but we do have more animals than boys. Let me just give a brief statement. To start, Alaska is a unique area when compared to the rest of the nation. The main reason for that is many people here live off the road system in remote locations. Personally, I have a number of patients who live in Squintna, Alexander Creek, Petersville, Cantwell, Glen Allen, Valdez, Bethel, Port Ellsworth, and Seldovia. So I do have some understanding of how this works. I also have a physician's assistant who works with me, who worked in the federal healthcare system for 15 years in the villages. Catherine and I have talked about this quite a bit. Basically, she was the only person many times in these clinics. This was not ideal. It was very demanding. Sometimes she didn't have the health care available. And this presents a problem because these patients need to be transferred from a remote location to Anchorage. If the weather's good, this is not a problem, but that's not always guaranteed in Alaska. Once the patient gets into Anchorage, the patient's evaluated by a new physician and a diagnostic workup starts. Sometimes that can take more time than expected. You need an MRI, but the MRI can't be scheduled. You find something and the patient then needs to see another physician. You find something else, the patient needs a surgeon. All of this can take time. And suddenly, the patient has unanticipated needs of housing, clothing, food, outpatient care. And then once the medical issue has been diagnosed and hopefully fixed, they need transportation back, which might again be delayed by weather. All of this can be incredibly expensive, it's complex, it requires a lot of medical and community services, and is emotionally distressing for patients and their families. And this is totally unique to Alaska, where we can't always drive where we need to be. Now, I do want to thank you, because there's an invaluable tool that Alaskans have, telehealth. And House Bill 265 was passed. I greatly appreciate this, because it really allows us to provide care remotely that otherwise wouldn't be available. Now, my view of my responsibility on the board is basically to help regulate the practice of medicine in Alaska per the legal statutes, to contribute to the professionalism of the medical community up here, and to focus on protecting both the public and healthcare providers in the practice of medicine. I think my experience both in rural medicine here, in medicine in large metropolitan areas such as Denver, and also in both the inpatient and outpatient field for 20 years is invaluable in that. But also, I think my career in the aviation industry with focus on self-evaluation and remaining current with training and technology are imperative. So I honestly hope you'll give me an opportunity to participate and contribute. Are there any questions I can answer?
Yes, Representative Fields.
Thanks, Dr. Barnes, for testifying today through the chair. I was just wondering, given your long experience practicing here in Alaska, what you think the state can do to address the lack of care for folks on Medicare. And I was curious, just in your experience as a, if I understand, a primary care physician in the Valley, you know, what does it look like when you're considering whether you can take a Medicare patient? How does that affect your practice? I just appreciate learning more about that, both in terms of what you see as a provider and what the state can do to address that issue. Thank you.
Certainly. This is a can of worms that, wow. I know when I first came up here, there had been something passed. I don't remember it. This was in 2003. It could be researched. I think it was part of the 9/11 bills that passed through the Senate and the House, but there was an increased reimbursement rate for Medicare patients, and I believe it was 40% above the nationwide rate. That eventually sundowned. This is a significant problem for primary care physicians. I'm an internal medicine doctor. I typically deal with the most complex cases. But we're also primary care for adults. And I have to tell you, I've never seen financial pressure like we're experiencing now. Insurance companies are decreasing the amount of reimbursement. To be very bluntly honest, Medicare, for a standard Medicare visit for 1 hour with a patient, reimburses about $100 to $120. You can very quickly do the math and understand that physicians are going to go bankrupt if we have to live under those requirements. But it's also a felony to charge more. And patients don't understand that their secondary insurance doesn't make up the difference between what commercial insurance used to be reimbursing. Now, personally, I think it's unethical to get rid of Medicare patients, to so-called, you know, quote, fire them, unquote, although I know a number of physicians who have had to do that in order to stay in business. If you're seeing, 12 patients a day and you're only getting $1,200, that doesn't even pay the overhead for your staff, your lease, your medical licensing, your malpractice, any of it. I keep all my Medicare patients when they go from, age 64 to 65, and approximately 50% of my practice is Medicare and Medicaid both. So how do I do it? Well, I have hired a physician's assistant who sees my Medicare patients and allows me to keep them in the practice. And then Catherine and I just talk regularly about any complications that come up. But unfortunately, I think this is probably going to have to occur on the federal level, and I don't know how we do it. It's truly a can of worms, and I've never seen such pressure being exerted on physicians. Did that answer the question?
Actually, through the chair, I really appreciate that insight, and it's interesting to understand just the ratios that you can kind of accept and keep a clinic open. And just through the chair, if I might follow up, we've got young kids, and it's been interesting to see kind of what practices in Anchorage accept kids on Medicaid. And we've been with practices that do accept kids on Medicaid, and I think that's really important. And I would just hope that as you get confirmed, assuming you do, to the medical board, you think about and I hope educate us on what we can do to maintain access, whether for young kids or older Alaskans. I think it's something that's received inadequate public attention.
Is there anything that the legislature can do? I mean, Medicare and Medicaid are both primarily federally funded. So are there any options that we would have? And I hate to reduce things to money, but a medical practice is a business like everything else. And when you do the math, as I spoke to the numbers, it's what does one do? I don't know. I would love to work with you guys on that, but I'm just not certain what we can do at a state level.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Sadler. Representative Ruffridge, sorry.
Well, thank you, Chair Prox. And thank you, Dr. Barnes, for being here and being willing to serve on this board. You had mentioned telehealth and House Bill 265, which is relatively new legislation. Have you had experience with telehealth? If so, what does that look like, and how have you used telehealth in your practice, or how do you anticipate that being used going forward?
I'm sorry, I have a warped sense of humor. Do you want me to lie to you or tell you the truth?
Please, tell me the truth.
It's glitchy. Patients don't understand how it works, and especially elderly patients who are not technologically geared, it can be difficult. But it's also been very beneficial. Some patients, with COVID were, too ill to get in. It allowed us to take care of them, some of the basic things. My concerns about telehealth are just if it's a complex situation, patients, put too much trust in it. Many cases, you need to sit down with a patient. You need to look them in the eye. You need to listen to their heart, that sort of thing. But my gosh, for triage, for helping, in the villages, I think telehealth is incredible. Now, I do know there are some remote telehealth machines, electronic devices where you can listen to the heart. You can get blood pressures. It has to have usually a nurse or somebody on the other end, but that, if we could get more of that, I think that would be very beneficial. Private practices, I don't know of any that have that, because I think those devices are on the order of at least $25,000 to $30,000 to start.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Barnes, you noted you have a sense of humor, so I have one as well, so I'm just going to note that you're an instrument-rated pilot and a doctor. So, sir, what color is your Bonanza?
No, Bonanzas are fork-tailed doctor killers. You can't get in those.
I understand that. But through the chair, again, follow up on a more serious note. Thanks for laughing, sir. We had a bill before us for direct health care agreements, which is not the same as concierge care, but the same word is sometimes referred to both. I'd appreciate knowing your thoughts about the utility or practicality and the benefit of direct health care agreements in Alaska.
This is another big issue, because I feel that, it goes back to, the reimbursement thing. If physicians keep getting pushed, ultimately what is going to happen. Physicians are either going to go out of business. They are going to be forced into large groups where healthcare, I think, ultimately will be more rationed, or they will be forced to go into concierge care. My fear with concierge care is that it is geared only to people who can pay for it, which is not good. Healthcare, needs to be available. People should be able to find it affordable. And I'm just concerned that concierge care it's not necessarily good. It's good and it's bad, if that makes sense.
The chair, follow?
Follow
it. I appreciate many thorny questions do not have a clear answer, so the acknowledgement of the gray answer is encouraging. I'd like to ask another question. What was my other one? I was going to just make a note that we talked about Medicare reimbursement rates. I did see there is a bill on the other side of our building which would increase the state's Medicare reimbursement rates. So there are some efforts legislatively, I guess, for you as much as our committee, that there are efforts to try and address that reimbursement rate issue. So that's
thank
a comment,
you for
not a question.
Answering my question, because Medicare reimbursement rate has to go up. I don't see an alternative fix for it.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Dr. Barnes, the Dunleavy administration and the Department of Health have put together what I think is a pretty inspiring Healthy Families Initiative. And I would hope that focus on public health, improving health outcomes, could be kind of a way that we organize our policy consideration, our budgets in the years ahead. And just wanted to ask if you had given any thought to how your role on this board might intersect with the Department of Health and the administration's focus on improving public health measures, which in turn lead to better outcomes in terms of literacy, reducing incarceration rates, and so on. Thank you.
All of those are incredible goals that I hope we can achieve. I'm not familiar with this push. I don't know if on the medical board I will have much to do with it, because as I understand my role on the board, it's mainly supervision of physicians, healthcare providers, patients, making sure that everything operates safely and efficiently. But anything we can do on the board to help that, I'm fully in favor of.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative McCormick. Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Dr. Barnes, for your testimony thus far. I guess one question I wanted to ask is, you mentioned having a customer in Bethel. I was wondering if you'd expand on your experience working with Bush, Alaska, kind of in that region, and maybe if your experience expands further than just Bethel, and maybe kind of, like I said, that region overall.
And it's Dillingham, it's Bethel. I have patients in other villages. I can't remember. They're typically teachers who come in summertime and Christmas break, basically. Some of the Bethel patients work in the prison system out there. The complaints I hear are just, accessibility of healthcare is so doggone limited. Getting medications is limited. Travel is one of the big things I addressed. I don't know how to solve this. Telehealth, I think, is one of the ways to do it. I would love to see more physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners out off the road system as well. But how much of that is Alaska funded and how much of it is federally funded? That I don't know.
Okay. Representative McCormick first. Did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Saber.
Through the chair, my final question to you, Dr. Barnes. You have an interesting career trajectory. You took a bit of a 90-degree turn there, going from Russian studies and international security to medicine. Just what prompted that turn in your career and your life?
The collapse of the Soviet Union.
Большое спасибо.
Пожалуйста.
All right. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, a comment and a question. First, thank you for your comments on telehealth. I helped carry HB 265 last year for Rep. Spahn Holtz. So really appreciate all the positive comments on telehealth. And I know that your role with the state medical board is really essential in helping to regulate telehealth in the way that best aligns with the interests of patients and for physicians. But my question is just related to a different topic. Health equity is a big conversation when we're talking about how different populations and population health have different health outcomes, as well as, you know, the crossover between the social determinants of health. And so I'm curious what your perspective or thoughts are related to those two topics.
It's an interesting situation. When I went to medical school, obviously Fort Worth, Texas, the Hispanic population and Native American population in Texas is quite high. And there are certainly diseases that, you know, disproportionately affect those populations, such as diabetes, hypertension. Interestingly enough, in the black population, blood pressure medications, specifically amlodipine, work better in the black population than they do in the white population. And we don't know why. This is another tough question with a lot of gray in it that I don't know how to answer. I think if you can just expand healthcare for everybody, it would help in those areas. There's such a deficit of healthcare in many areas that getting more providers into Alaska certainly would be helpful. We have a lack of providers here, in my opinion, but how do we recruit physicians to come to Alaska? I would love to see actual physicians out in the villages as well, more than PAs and that sort of thing. But recruiting somebody to do that is difficult.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Barnes. And with that, we will move on to the next appointee. Up for confirmation, we have Anita Halterman for the Mental Health Trust Board, Mental Health Trust Board of Trustees. And Ms. Halterman, are you with us? Ms. Halterman, can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Please
thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record and your resume.
Thank you. Honorable Representative Prax from the House Test Committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to introduce myself for consideration of appointment to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board. For the record, my name is Anita Marie Halterman. I'm a public servant, and I have been for most of my career. My husband, Mark, and I have been married for over 38 years. We met in Fort Lewis, Washington, where we both were stationed in the United States Army. Since that time, we've mostly raised our family in both Delta Junction and Eagle River, Alaska. Some of you may know me from my brief tenure working with the Alaska State Legislature during the 29th legislative session. Over the years, I've gotten to know many of you, and while I've reached out to some of you already, I have not been able to connect with you all, but that time will come, and I look forward to it. I am happy to be considered for renewal to my appointment to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority's Board of Trustees. I actively took my role on the Board of Trustees in August of 2019, filling in for a trustee who needed to step down before her term had ended. I am now being considered for my first full term as trustee. My path leading me to the trust is a unique one. My employer asked me to seek appointments to boards or commissions on behalf of our business interests so that I could open more doors for sales of risk management solutions. I submitted a long application directly to the governor's office that outlined my skills and abilities, and I asked for them to consider me for a number of open opportunities, not yet fully understanding the opportunities nor the time commitment that was to come. The trust had not yet been identified as an open opportunity, but when the opportunity presented, I was asked, and I quickly took a role. After joining that board, I assumed several leadership roles on the board. I held the role of chair of Audit and Risk Committee, I later assumed the role of vice chair in May of 2020, and then the finance committee chair in November of 2020. By January of 2022, I'd become chair. At one point, I was serving in three roles at one time. Despite already starting my work on the trust, I've been anxiously awaiting confirmation for my own term. Serving on the board of trustees so far has been an enlightening and powerful journey, one that is expanding my knowledge of the mental health needs, budgets, and many programs that are offered throughout Alaska and funded by the trust and our other partners. I have worked with trust beneficiaries in a variety of roles, paid and unpaid, for most of my career. I enjoy giving back to my community, and doing so, I have learned on this board how to be actively engaged in new strategies and funding opportunities that can help shape meaningful reform for our mental health programs. I'd very much like to continue those efforts. As a child, I witnessed untreated mental health issues firsthand. I was ripped away from my own family and placed into foster care several times during my childhood, but sadly not until years after neglect and abuse had occurred. After graduating high school, I joined the United States Army. I met my husband while in the service, and I first arrived in Alaska in the mid-1980s after discharging from the United States Army. I followed my husband to Alaska. He was stationed at Fort Greely in Delta Junction. We raised our eldest daughter there during the first few years of our life, and we fell in love with Alaska. While we watched the economy suffer in the mid-80s, and we had to leave Alaska for a brief time, we came back as soon as we could, and we've lived in Eagle River, Alaska for 28 years since our return. I currently possess an MBA, which I obtained from Wayland Baptist University in Anchorage in 2016 while I was working as a chief of staff for a local legislator. I have extensive background working mainly within the Department of Health and Social Services Medicaid programs in both Iowa and Alaska, spending my last 7 years working with Department of Health and Social Services Senior and Disability Services, mediating administrative appeals and serving as a program manager and a supervisor. I've been involved in budget development for the Department of Health and Social Services since my regulatory development days, where I served as a Medicaid analyst in the late 1990s and early 2000s. At that time, I developed fiscal notes for regulatory projects for Alaska Medicaid. Since then, my exposure to budgets grew, as did my understanding of how programs in Alaska are funded. I have had experience working with child support, the Department of Corrections, public safety, and public assistance programs. I've devoted my entire life to working with populations that are underserved. I've had family members in need of guardianship, and I've lost an adult daughter to drug addiction. Recently, I lost a woman I called mom to cancer. Her addiction issues were an issue for her as she prepared to die. I currently watch in horror as our mental health issues continue to rip our families apart. I continue to study the issues, such as our Crisis Now implementation efforts. I do that for the benefit of our trust beneficiaries, and I continue to look for new solutions. I find it rewarding to improve programs and systems in order to allow the better provision of services for the beneficiaries of those programs. The trust has allowed me to gain additional insight into funding, policy development, and it has allowed me to grow into a better public servant with new ideas and energy that I hope will continue to allow the trust to contribute to finding solutions that work for all Alaskans. Since starting working on the trust board, I no longer work for an information technology company. I've since worked for a media production company, for which I also currently no longer work. The time commitment for the trust became an issue for my employers and for me. And my experience, however, working in the public sector, positioning risk management solutions, human resource, and other solutions for businesses, has given me new perspective about the healthcare needs for privately insured individuals, and it's expanded my understanding of a more global workforce and healthcare issues that Alaskans face. I have actively participated in budget development activities for many years, and my skills in this area continue to grow. My exposure to resource development issues in both the legislature and while serving on the trust has uniquely positioned me with new skills and a fresh perspective. I very much hope that I am able to continue using my experience to help reform programs for now and for the future so that we can sustain them for populations that need the most. I look forward to working with you to continue to improve the lives of our trust beneficiaries as we work in partnership with the legislature, the departments, and our other stakeholders to build an integrated, comprehensive mental health program that better meets our trust beneficiary needs. I want to thank you for your consideration. I appreciate your support, and I look forward to working with you all to protect and enhance the trust and to maximize its benefits to solve Alaskans' mental health problems.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Hoffman from the committee, Mr. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair, Anita Hoffman. For the record, I guess Anita is a personal friend. She's a constituent of many years. And I think that you are an exemplar of the phenomenon we have in Alaska of service members coming to Alaska on orders and staying behind when they get out of service to contribute like you have mightily to the quality of our community. So thank you for your service. Thank you for what you've done. You had a heck of a resume, and I'm impressed that you have sacrificed your vocational aspirations to continue service on the Mental Health Trust Board. Having said that, I look forward to supporting you, but I'm going to ask you two general questions. How well, in your opinion, is the trust doing in meeting its mission to provide for beneficiaries and to generate money from the trust assets and resources that it manages? How well is it doing on those two fronts? One, to generate revenue from resources, and two, to provide for beneficiary needs?
I'll answer the resource question first. Representative Sadler, through the chair, we are doing phenomenally well with regards to our resource development and the income that we produce from our investments. We rely very heavily on the Department of Revenue and the Department or the Permanent Fund Division to manage most of our resources. The Trust Land Office has done a phenomenal job of managing our real estate holdings as well as our trust lands in order to ensure that we can develop them in a manner that allows us to maximize the revenue that we generate from that trust land when they lease and or sell parcels through public process. I'm just impressed at the portfolio and the resources that we have at our disposal to help guide us as we make decisions that are in the best interest of our Alaskans. And I think in the resource development area, we do well. There are areas that we can improve on, such as beneficiary engagement and understanding over resource development and what that does for Alaskans, especially those with mental health and substance abuse issues. But we are working on those things, and we will continue to work on those things. And as we do, I think we will see improvements in understanding the connection between resource development and the service that we provide. The second question was with regards to whether or not we serve our beneficiaries well. Is that correct?
That's good. To what degree are you serving your beneficiaries? And remind us, please, who those beneficiaries are.
The beneficiaries of the trust are statutorily defined within categories of Alzheimer's, dementia. I don't want to leave any out, so I'm gonna skip past the categories, but they are substance abuse, mental health beneficiaries that receive services typically through government agencies and or nonprofits. They are statutorily defined, and we generate funding through our resource development activities, and we supply that funding to government agencies and or nonprofits that serve beneficiaries. We have a comp plan that we reference, which we work with the departments to develop, and we are currently in the process of conducting a survey to strengthen the system. We are only as strong as those partnerships. The trust is a funder of projects. We typically, I would like to see us fund projects that we currently don't get requests for, but we can only fund shovel-ready projects. So we have to use technical support to provide support to folks that are on the edge but not quite there, and we are constantly working to improve our relationships. I think we could do a better job in reaching rural communities, We have done a lot to make improvements in that area over the last several years. The crisis now implementation will get us much further to that regard than I think a lot of projects that we've undertaken over the years, but we still have a lot of work to do. We could use telemedicine more effectively. We have limits based on insurance and their willingness to pay for that kind of service, though. Medicaid is unfortunately primarily the primary funding source for that kind of service in the state of Alaska, and or the tribal system, which has some federal exceptions that don't apply to the rest of the population. Our Medicare beneficiaries are the ones that suffer the most, and unfortunately many of our Medicare beneficiaries do become trust beneficiaries if they aren't in their younger years, as we face aging diseases such as Alzheimer's and dementia. Could we do a better job of serving those people? Absolutely. The state of Alaska has never been able to receive a waiver to serve those populations from the federal government. So we've never been able to work in partnership to do a better job than what we currently do at serving that particular population. But we can work with the department when they're ready, and we will work to get them ready if we can. I mean, we are poised and we have the resources to do those kind of things. I would like to see us continue in those regards, helping to support the department as they move forward with all their reforms, rate-setting changes, technology changes, systems changes. There's so much that needs to be done. But we are not the only funder of these options. You know, the federal government funds a lot of those initiatives. We are a partner. The state GF funds, the legislature appropriates funds for programs that we work in partnership with. So it's a concerted effort. We have to all work together to improve these programs.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any other representative reference?
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Halterman, for being here today and being willing to serve. We heard testimony in this committee few weeks ago regarding Alaska's report card in mental health, and it seems like Alaska continues in a trend in the direction maybe we, none of us, you included, want it to go, is in regards to our mental health component, increasing rates of depression and suicide. What role do you see the trust taking in helping to curb that, putting that in a different direction? Obviously, there's a funding component. Is there room for additional funding? I know the trust has, as you said before, resources are going well. Is there more that the trust can do, in your opinion?
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, I think there's more all of us can do. The Department of Justice report is very concerning, especially when it comes to our children. You know, I worked with a department many years ago on the Bring the Children Home initiative, and we were heading in the right direction. But unfortunately, when we have workforce shortages and we can no longer provide services in the manner that we used to do, we have to reexamine our systems and find efficiencies in other ways to better serve populations. You know, the trust does not provide programs. We provide funding. So if you look at the Department of Justice report, the trust is not identified as a party that is parcel to that findings. We are a funder. We will work with the departments to try to improve where we can. And when they come to us in partnership and let us know that they have needs that we can maybe meet, I think the trust should be there. We should be there, and so should the legislature. My guess is any funding requests that come to try to improve the system as it currently sits is going to be a joint request. It's going to be something where the trust is going to be asked to kick up some resources to meet a need, and I would imagine that the state would also be expected to cough up some money to meet a need. But we have to fully understand what those needs are and where we're headed in which direction to try to improve that, and we have to start looking outside the box. We have to do things differently because what we're doing now is not working. And so, yes, we can fund more. You know, the board has some latitude with regards to the budget and where we devote our resources. But we, I mean, we fund a lot of programs in the state that do help beneficiaries that are not necessarily government-funded people, and not all of our beneficiaries rely on Medicaid, Medicare. Many of them may be on private sector insurance or even uninsured still. We still have populations that do not fall under the rules to be covered by these government-funded programs that typically provide for mental health services. Medicaid has been a primary funder for mental health around the country since the 1980s when we started to deinstitutionalize individuals across the country. And it's been a political mess since. Our populations are the ones that suffer because we don't want people institutionalized. But the reality is we have to provide services in an appropriate setting, and we don't have the settings in Alaska to do that in many cases. We need to work to build that infrastructure. That's what our primary goal should be.
Thank you. Just a follow-up to that, if I may. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned there are programs and services. Potentially there's, as a funder, the trust and the state could partner and potentially funding those at a higher level. If it were up to you, what programs or services do you think the trust or the state could get behind that are currently working and may need additional resources to take to the next level?
I would love to focus on maternal health programs. I think if we can hit our children when they're young and then providing their families with the appropriate resources while children are still developing, we can avoid much of what we face with our populations that grow sicker as they age because they can't access care when they're young. You know, when we have babies that do not get appropriate prenatal care, the outcome for mom and baby are not good. It starts at a young age. I would love to see us focus a lot more energy on our younger populations and our families, but we cannot forget our seniors as we work on this as well. They also need services, and we're lacking them in Alaska. So it's hard for me to say one or the other. I think it needs to be a balance of both.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Ms. Alterman. I completely agree about maternal health programs, and no reason you would have been following Ms. Alterman, but the Department of Health has been before this committee several times this year explaining some of these different programs, and, you know, unfortunately, some of them, like infant learning, have had declining funding with inflation to the point that they aren't able to provide support for all the kids they screen as being behind in developmental milestones. So I think kind of following up on Representative Ruffridge's questions, just continuing to educate legislators about the return on investment in these programs would have a lot of value, because I certainly don't feel like I have a mastery of all of them, and I'm on the committee that's hearing about them, so I can only assume that others would benefit from learning about them as well, and just wanted to commend you for your attention to that and advising us. I did have a question, if I might. When the Department of Health was here, they went through their health kind of metrics, and the worst one was increased risk of suicide and mental health issues among teens, which kind of mirrors, I think, what we've seen in a lot of states with social media, which makes me think, well, maybe we should be doing something, not just in terms of public health, but in terms of regulation of social media companies. Other states have pursued this. I'm just curious if that's something that you've thought about as a trustee, or if other board members have thought about it. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. And that's an interesting one. I will tell you, as a chief of staff, our office was approached with a cybersecurity bill from a teenager that was concerned about the impact on her peers and her school because of the bullying that was happening online. And I do think, unfortunately, we live in a different world where it's easy to pick on the weakest child in that setting. And it's not okay. I don't know that there's an easy answer about how to regulate it. I mean, I know that I studied it some in an attempt to try to introduce a prospective piece of legislation. And I found sorting through the answers kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack. What's the answer? You know, I mean, there aren't easy answers. I think it's, you know, I mean, we have to have opportunities for our children, constructive outlets. Our children should not be kept from sports, you know, I mean, school activities because of a resource issue. And unfortunately, our children typically live in poverty. Most children these days seem to have been born through the Medicaid program, and they live in poverty much of their lives. And unfortunately, a lot of these children, if they had access to constructive outlets, would make different choices. I think boredom does a lot of bad things to children. They can do some dangerous things with social media. I've had blowouts in my own home with my children that have done things on social media to sabotage each other because they were having a fight, you know, and you have to diffuse it in your own home. So, I mean, for me, I mean, I took a kind of morbid approach to it, but I handed two butter knives to my children and told them to duke it out because I couldn't get them to stop fighting. And they looked at me like I was nuts and the fight stopped. That's not really the way we can deal with it in society. We have to take a meaningful approach and looking at what controls we can put in place, what other options we can give our children. You know, children that have hope for a future, opportunities, that know that there's something they can do, will have a better outlook and be more constructive with their time than children that are sitting there bored who have no ability to take advantage of anything in our community. I think we've got to focus our energies a little differently. We've got to give our kids some opportunities. We've got to give them jobs for the future. You know, they've got to see something optimistic to look forward to. Right now, a lot of our children are just looking for the first ticket out of Alaska because they don't see opportunities here. That creates a very bored environment where kids get into trouble. When kids are not supervised or they don't have something constructive to do, they find things to do that may not be in their best interest. It may not be in society's best interest. So it definitely suits us well to find better outlets for them as a society. And we should work in that regard.
Okay, thank you. Other Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, Ms. Halderman, I want to thank you for your service to the board and to many different organizations and causes in Alaska and for sharing your personal experience. One question that I had is related to Crisis Now, and I appreciated your perspective talking about the work that the trust does to fund services and work in partnership with the state, private entities, et cetera. And so I'm curious what your current perspective is on the status of Crisis Now, the funding that it currently has compared to the interest and demand of Crisis Now implementation in many communities across the state, and how us in the legislature can continue to support Crisis Now and the trust in those efforts.
Thank you for that question through the chair. That's a loaded question. Fund it. There's GF expenditure requests, and that would be my first response to that. Second response is we have rolled out Crisis Now in the major communities in Alaska. We have yet a lot of work to do in rural Alaska. We have got to work in partnership to expand our outreach further. And supporting a peer support model in, you know, the trust is working on that now, and it should help some. But we've got to get capital projects together in communities, and we've got to give people infrastructure. We have to have flexibility. Exploring telemedicine for other outlets that would improve our system overall. Those are things that we can do to try to improve the system. But funding them is critical, and the trust cannot be the only funder of the crisis implementation efforts. It has to be a cooperative effort where the legislature appropriates GF funding in addition to the trust funds. And if we need to dig deeper in the trust budget for funding for crisis implementation, the trust can do that, but it comes at the sacrifice of other program areas that are outlined in our comp plan. So we have to make decisions. What's the most important? It's hard. Last year, we made decisions in our budget discussion to make adjustments to our budget. We were trying to reallocate another $800,000 for foster care programs. And rather than cutting any of the other programs, the trustees dug deep into reserves to make sure that we appropriated additional funding for programs that we felt were important, because we could not find it in our hearts to cut anything because we are already in crisis. The whole country's in crisis. Everybody's moving backwards when it comes to serving their populations well when it comes to mental health. The reimbursement hadn't been there. You know, I mean, for most of the states, mental health services are not well reimbursed. And Medicaid being a primary funder, we've already heard from the last appointee being considered that, unfortunately, these populations are not being served. Or if they are, providers are limiting the number of them they will serve. How many of them are not served at all? We can't answer that question. But we know it's happening because we see a crisis unfolding in front of ourselves.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? I had one. Ms. Alterman, you mentioned, I think you worked for a company that was involved in risk management. I think of insurance when I hear risk management, but could you elaborate on that experience a little bit and how it might apply to the mental health trust board?
Thank you for that question. And actually, I worked for two risk management companies. And yes, the first was an insurance company. I worked providing supplemental benefits to employers for their workforce. So obviously, I sat with employees and the employers and went through their benefit plans with them. And many of our employers are dealing with working poor people. Many of them have Medicaid beneficiaries on their payroll. And I worked to provide supplemental plans for those that did not, or those that had Medicaid that needed supplemental plans. We, of course, placed policies for them as well. That gave me perspective about the private sector's healthcare needs because I was examining that environment on a daily basis when I was doing my discovery with those employers as we were going through their human resource options for supplemental benefits. The other risk management company was the IT company where we provided information technology solutions for businesses. And that gave me a different eye-opening with regards to risks for businesses. And that's with regards to cybersecurity and the fact that most Alaskans, unfortunately, are sitting ducks. So I have had two different exposures to risk management on a private sector level, and it really is an eye-opening experience to have had both of those experiences.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Halterman? All right, thank you. And with that, we will open public testimony on the confirmation of Anita Halterman to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board. Do we have anyone in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online that wishes to testify? And with that, we will close public hearing for Anita Halterman. And I forgot to ask the same question for, Mr. Barnes, who is the commissioner designee for the Mental Health Trust Board. So we will open public testimony for Commissioner designee David Barnes to the State Mental Health Trust Board. Is there anyone who wants to testify in the room on Mr. Barnes' appointment? And do we have anyone online? I'm not seeing anyone online for that. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify concerning Mr. Barnes' appointment to the State Mental Health Trust Board, to the State Medical Board? And with that, we will close public testimony. And next on our list, I have John Morris for the, John Morris, appointee to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees. Mr. Morris.
Hello, my name is John Morris. Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you. Please introduce yourself for the record and explain your resume and qualifications for this position.
Thank you, Chairman Prox, and distinguished members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. I appreciate you considering my nomination to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Board of Trustees. For the record, my name is John Morris, and I'm both honored and humbled to come before this committee today to share my personal experiences, education, and motivations in seeking to serve the beneficiaries of the trust. Successful trustees have ability in financial management and investment, in land management, or in service to beneficiaries of the trust. And we have some truly great trustees working on the board today, and while my knowledge and expertise is dwarfed by theirs, I do have personal experience and education touching on each of these facets of board work. By way of introduction, I've lived in Alaska for 7 years, and my wonderful wife, Cece, and I were married down in Homer 5 years ago, with our anniversary coming up here in May. She and I have chosen to make our lives here together in Alaska. My father's a firefighter, my mom a nurse, and during my childhood, my dad would take me with him on emergency medical calls in rural West Virginia. I did CPR for the first time when I was 12 years old. I learned a lot on those calls, not the least of which being the rewards of service to others. While in high school, I led a search dog team which successfully found and rescued a young hunter who suffered from developmental disabilities and got lost in the woods. Graduated valedictorian from a large city high school in West Virginia, then graduated from Wake Forest University with honors and degrees in chemistry and English. After returning to West Virginia for medical school, I completed anesthesia residency at the University of Pennsylvania. Due to strong personal interest, I took extra electives in psychiatry and worked outside of class during medical school with a psychiatrist specializing in adolescent psychiatry. After training, I entered academic medicine, primarily taking care of children requiring major surgery. After this, I took a year off from the full-time practice of medicine and worked with a colleague to document a prospectus for an investment portfolio. I managed other people's money, primarily friends and relatives, and kept track of its performance with an eye to starting a hedge fund. I studied rigorously and sat for the Chartered Financial Analyst Level 1 exam. Despite being successful monetarily, I returned to the active practice of medicine. During this time, I felt the responsibility of caring for someone else's hard-earned money while seeking to make prudent decisions on their behalf, in addition to the nuances of active trading and portfolio management. Returning to full-time anesthesia, I worked in Colorado and again in West Virginia in private practice. There I bought a 64-acre farm with mineral rights, where I received an unlooked-for education on several aspects of land management, including property rights, environmental impacts, and how to deal with corporate entities with differing desired uses of the land. For example, I worked with the Extension Service to determine the best agricultural use of the land, starting a hay farm called Four Dozen Farms, consulted with the State Department of Environmental Protection and engineers to deal with old coal mine runoff, and successfully litigated a right-of-way and environmental damage dispute with a large utility corporation, and going through the legal process of holding and conveying the property with and without mineral rights. In my daily practice of medicine, I routinely work with trust beneficiaries and have received formal training and professional experience with the full spectrum of organic brain injuries and disease, mental illness, and developmental challenges. My life has also been personally touched by mental illness. People who I have cared deeply for have suffered from dementia, depression, alcohol misuse, substance misuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and developmental delays. When I'm considering hiring someone, no matter what the job, I look first for motivation. Motivation, I feel, is the greatest asset I bring to this confirmation hearing. Caring for our beneficiaries is deeply personal to me. In their experiences, I see my own and the experiences of those I've cared for in the past. I've been awed more than once seeing someone else overcome something which I didn't think I could. There's nothing more Alaskan than caring for one another. Few things more uniquely Alaskan than the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Serving our beneficiaries as a trustee would be a true privilege. I thank you again for considering my nomination and would like to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Does the committee have any questions for Mr. Morris? Going once. Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair, Mr. Morris, for your willingness to serve and for your work to assist with homeless services in a challenging time for the municipality. After working on that and observing the intersection of local and state services firsthand, what lessons do you feel like you learned and maybe lessons that might inform what we can do as state legislators who want our localities to be successful in providing services for people experiencing homelessness. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Fields, for the question. As I've listened to the other nominees talk today, there haven't been any simple questions asked by any representatives today. As far as what the state legislature can do, there's a great many things. I think that the first missing piece is good data. I think that all too often decisions in the homeless space are made by anecdote or dare say even local sentiment rather than scientific data. The remit for the Mental Health Trust is significantly broader than persons experiencing homelessness. And I think that the testimony from Mrs. Alterman earlier was excellent on what we can do together and must do together. Neither the legislature or the Mental Health Trust or really any other entity alone will not be successful moving the needle on persons experiencing homelessness, and certainly not with mental health.
Thank you. Mr. Ruffridge, Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, and thank you for being here to testify for us today and for your willingness to serve. I guess similar questions to the ones that I'd asked for Ms. Halterman, just regarding our current mental health issues in our state, increasing risks of suicide for some of our young people, as Representative Fields have mentioned. How can the trust prioritize where their monies are spent either better, or what are programs that are potentially working that you feel need support?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ruffridge, for the question. I would say three things. First, again, Ms. Halterman's testimony was excellent, and I agreed with it on what we can do broadly. Second, I think that maybe four things. Secondly, I think it would be very foolish of me to weigh in on details about what the trust is doing or not doing when I'm not on the trust yet. It has been impressed upon me that it is a wealth of information that I need to digest to make good decisions and responsible decisions. In my day-to-day job, I make relatively high-stakes decisions routinely. I hate to do them in the absence of good information. So I'm reluctant to do so now. That said, I think that my two last things, I believe that what gets measured gets done. I think that's a true thing. Also, that the statutory mandate of an integrated and comprehensive mental health system that prioritizes people at risk of hospitalization is spot on, and that should be our focus as trustees.
Just a follow-up to that, and thank you for the statement of what gets measured gets done. I appreciate that. I think the legislature certainly takes that approach to many things as well. However, when it comes to mental health in Alaska, it seems like we do measure it. And maybe the concern is that there are things that are not being done. The trust has a very difficult role in determining what priorities to put money behind and what not to. Do you think that there are better ways that we could do things in Alaska that we should be prioritizing that we currently aren't? Or is there another path we should be taking in order to get some better results with our current mental health issues?
Well, thank you, Representative Ruffridge. Through the chair, broadly, we can always do better. That said, I would say that, again, I don't have the accurate information to pick out policy changes that I would recommend for the trust before I have the opportunity to attend a trust meeting. I've read, frankly, the entirety of the website information on the Mental Health Trust. I too have read what I think are frankly depressing statistics on suicide and a few other metrics that frankly are just terrible. And I can only promise you that my motivation to move the needle on those measurements is very, very high. And I look forward to the opportunity to work with the other trustees and the staff of the Mental Health Trust to make that happen.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay. I had one. You mentioned that you had experience in financial management and land management. I don't know, have you had a chance to look at the Mental Health Trust's investment portfolio?
Not in great deep, forgive me, Chairman Prox. To be honest, I have not read the entirety of the Trust Land Office website. And so my knowledge there is less. I know that the holdings are extensive, and I'm aware of the history of the trust in terms of its land management, and I'm somewhat familiar with the reliance and the great partnership with the permanent fund in managing the money.
Okay, thank you. Fair enough. And do you have any thoughts in that regard? I guess I recognize that you haven't been to a trust board meeting and all that, but do you have any thoughts on possibly the direction from the investment and income producing side of the responsibility?
Well, I know that there, Chairman Fox, thank you. I'm aware that there's been a fair bit of history, particularly between the legislature and the trust, up to and including an audit a few years back. I would echo Mrs. Halterman's testimony that the portfolio is, from what I've seen, is doing remarkably well, and it's, you know, it is incumbent on trustees to make sure that the trust remains solvent, particularly in times of high inflation like we're in now. More in anything more granular than that, again, frankly, I just hate talking when I don't have all the information.
Yeah, I understand. Fair enough. Any other questions from the committee? Any closing comments, Mr. Morris?
Well, no, thank you for the opportunity. It's frankly, it's I'm very excited by the just the chance to work on behalf of the beneficiaries, and it's been an extraordinary process so far, just trying to learn what there is to learn.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we will open public testimony on appointee John Morris to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees. Do we have anyone in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, do we have anyone online that wishes to testify on Mr. Morris's appointment? I'm there. Okay, and seeing none, I will close public testimony. And I want to thank again all those that did take part of their life, really, and offer that in service to the state. We all really appreciate that. So, with that, Riley, do you have the hearing sheet?
Yes. Yeah.
All right, let's take an at ease while we sign that report. Back on record, so the House Health and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications of John Morris, Governor's appointee to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees and forwards his nomination to the full legislature to consider for confirmation. And the same can be said for Ms. Anita Halterman to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees, and Mr. David Barnes, the governor's appointee, to the state medical board. And we forward their nominations to the full legislature. And signing the report does not reflect any individual's recommendations for approval or disapproval. So with that, the other thing that we were going to talk about today was our amendments to House Bill 115, and getting that sorted out turned out to be a little bit bigger project than we thought, and we don't have the information back from Legislegal and the department. So do we have the committee substitute to hand out? Sorry?
Everybody has it.
We have that. Okay, so if you would please review that tomorrow and over the weekend, and we will try and get back together and sort that out on Tuesday when we meet next. And are there any other comments from the committee or any other business to come before the committee? So with that, I'll adjourn the House and Social Services Committee at 4:18 p.m.